the story that I'm going to start my sermon with today, I'm actually completely unsure if I have told before in a sermon, but with the week I've had, you get what you get today. It's a story that I first heard when I was a seminarian from another preacher, and the truth is that when I listen to a story, I take it in and make it my own and probably change it, and then when I retell it, probably tell it completely wrong. So it's not clear that my point I took from this story is the point the speaker originally intended, but I like my version better. It's originally from the work of Lauren Isley, who's a naturalist and a storyteller and a writer. And the point that I took from it is essentially that it's a story about blessed irrelevance. It's a story about doing, not because of the expected end result, but because not doing isn't an option. You may have heard it before, and so to the best of my recollection, I give you the story of the star thrower. It is about a biologist who's on a working vacation in some distant, lovely island coast. He would wake up every day and walk the beach when the tide went out, watching as the local shell collectors scoured the sand, picking up the abandoned prizes of the sea. The sand dollars, the conch shells, the starfish, all those creatures that the receding waters had left behind. Knowing full well that the thriving tourist market in this lovely little place would pay handsomely for such small treasures, the collectors came each day to make their living from the sea, piling the little creatures in great buckets, carrying them with work-worn arms over to bonfires that would boil away the dirt, the muck, and the life from them, converting the sand dollars and the starfish into a saleable commodity. Now, as all of this happened every single morning, the biologist walked the beach, and he watched from a little distance away. He didn't make any grand pronouncements, no big moral gestures. He just watched as little deaths, the tiniest of deaths, scattered out along the beach in front of him. Seeing them there, dried and dying in the early light of the morning before the collectors came, this man who had no particular love of starfish, no great compulsion to ban the collection of ocean creatures, no nothing except a morning walk, suddenly felt an overwhelming sadness, an unnamed sadness, a sadness that might have had something to do with the meaningless of little deaths, that might have had something to do with the imminence of all deaths. But still, despite all of that, in the presence of all of that, the next morning he got up before the collectors, went out onto that tiny portion of beach, which was itself vaster than his imagining, and threw some starfish back into the sea. He threw them back, even as the tide drug them back in. He threw them back even as the collectors gathered their baskets for another day. He threw them back knowing he was not their savior, for fate and death and the tides were not in his control. He threw them back not because he was sure he could save them, not because he was being a hero, but not because he was successfully operating a rescue effort, but because he had arms for throwing and because he could do no other. Though that same afternoon would bring with it just as full a beach of little deaths as the afternoon before, the thrower of starfishes, knowing that his work might yield little tangible results, threw those starfishes anyway. Every morning, in defiance of the tides, in defiance of death itself, because he had to, he threw those starfishes. One of my favorite spiritual authors, Henry Nouwen, makes a bold proclamation that reminds me of all that went unspoken when I heard that story and cried. Nouwen says that, quote, "The Christian leader of the future is called to be completely irrelevant and to stand before the world with nothing to offer but his or her own vulnerable self." Now, I know that we are not the Christian leaders of the future, But we are leaders of today, in our work lives, in our church, in our families. And I cried when I thought about the star thrower, because I was aching for something in our tradition and in our modern society which recognized the absolute blessedness of an act of complete, holy, vulnerable irrelevance. An act not done for glory or victory or even righteousness, but because we have arms for throwing and we can do no other. Because there is a service to do. Because we don't have to win every time to do the good work of leadership in our church and in our world. I have preached from this pulpit before that moral acts are purer when they are done without reward or expectation of reward. UU minister Dick Gilbert says we should all aspire to, quote, be good for nothing. People who do good for no reward but for the thing itself. That's what we should be. And in preaching this, I have found it easy to reassure us in our religious context that our ethical decision-making might just be purer than that of those who labor under the promise of a final theistic judgment in the form of heaven or hell. I have found it easy, deceptively so, to communicate that good works done by those who do not expect a heavenly reward are just a little bit better than those who do the same in order to build an impressive resume for St. Peter at the gates. See? But Henry Nouwen's line that the leaders of the future are called to be completely irrelevant and stand before the world with nothing to offer but ourselves reminds me that even without the lure of heaven and the stars in our celestial crown, we liberal religious people still have a ways to go before we can claim that we are anything close to good for nothing. For even without heaven, we can find ourselves lured into action and leadership not by the purest motivation of the act itself, but by the grand temptation to be relevant, to be spectacular, to be powerful in our holy temporal game of justification by acts alone. For so many of us, it is relevance we are after rather than heaven. It is irrelevance we fear in the place of perdition. And the great reward at the end of it all is not pearly gates, but purpose. Not salvation, but success. Too often, even we liberals, just like our more theologically conservative counterparts, do because we get something out of the doing, and not because the doing is right. And yet Henry Nouwen, grounded in the love he experiences from his faith, musters the courage to stand bare before the world, to work tirelessly for justice, and yet never imagine himself that world's savior. And yet the thrower of starfishes manages to rise every morning and go about his appointed task, knowing all the while that what he does cannot be measured by achievement, knowing all the while that he will not be celebrated, and yet also knowing all the while that he must do. I guess this is my way of saying that I fear we Unitarian Universalists, in claiming our power in a world so in need, run a risk of focusing too much on the hoped-for fruits of our own labors and not enough on the motivations that guide those labors. Motivations which existed and will exist whether or not we succeed. Whether or not we grow our churches, whether or not we ever prove ourselves to be so deeply important and so deeply relevant. Sometimes I worry we focus on the outcome more than the work itself, and we lead ourselves down a lifetime aimed at success instead of a lifetime aimed at service. A lifetime of making meaning, woven too often around our power to bend the world toward our will. A lifetime of trying to make the world do what we want it to do, It seems like a fragile little web, easily pulled apart when the first big gust of wind comes by. For how fragile is love based on results? How delicate is a hope that only persists in the presence of sparkling success? How tender and easily injured is a sense of self that is only intact when we are winning at whatever game we have set before ourselves? Our motivations in life and in leadership must be strong. They must endure even through the lean times, even when all that we have done comes to nothing, or all that we have done takes too darn long to come to anything, or all that we have done is uncertain at best. Our motivations have to be stronger than success, and one motivation that might just work is service. Service born of love. Servant leadership. That term, servant leadership, was first coined by a motivational speaker and leadership coach named Robert Greenleaf. And I should admit that I am inherently skeptical of the entire genre of motivational leadership and leadership gurus and self-help. It just has some sort of cynicism that rises up in me anytime someone tries to sell a prepackaged formula for self-improvement. But Greenleaf has a point in his definition of servant leadership. The servant leader, he says, is servant first. It begins with the natural feeling that one wants to serve first. Then conscious choice might inspire one to lead. The person who is a servant leader is sharply different from the one who is a leader first. Perhaps because of the need to assuage an unusual power drive or to acquire material possessions, the leader first and the servant first are two extreme types. Between them are shadings and blends that are part of the infinite variety of human nature. His point, the servant leader is servant first. The servant leader comes to the task at hand not hell-bent on winning the game or coming out on top, but on doing what they can to meet the needs of the people they care about, doing what they can to facilitate the power of others, and doing what they can whether or not they control the outcome. The servant leader serves not out of a need to prove her relevance, but out of a need to express some measure of devotion to the people they love. That's why I love that reading by Meg Barnhouse, Waitressing in the Sacred Kitchens. She talks about what good work it is to do the simple, honest ministry of feeding people, bringing folks what they need, meeting the needs of hungry visitors who have come to be filled. It reminds me of what Jesus is supposed to have said to St. Peter. Tradition says that Jesus anointed Peter as the first leader of this Jesus movement, and when Peter asked him basically, "Lord, what do you want of me? What am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to lead?" Jesus said simply, "Feed my sheep." Feed my sheep. Not go build magnificent buildings and accumulate big sums of money and convert the whole universe to Christianity, but simply feed my sheep. What does leadership ask of us? It asks that we feed one another. Pass the good work from hand to hand and keep doing it with open hearts and, yes, high hopes, whether or not we become superstars in our own eyes or the eyes of the world. As Nouwen wrote when he came to understand himself as a servant first and a leader second, "I came to see that I had lived most of my life as a tightrope artist trying to walk on a high, thin cable from one tower to another, always waiting for the applause when I had not fallen and broken my leg." Let me tell you about servant leadership this week. Never in my tenure here at Brew have so many pastoral emergencies come at one time, including the needs of my own family. Never in the last 3.5 years, to my recollection, have so many brewers been openly and bravely hurting and shared that pain and the growth that comes with it with others. I know that there were times in the past when Brew lost too many people too close together, and I know from reports that you did then what you have done now. You served one another with grace and open hearts, without expectation of reward or promise of success or the least little complaint. You served one another, and you continue to do so. For the family of Wally Smith, whose memorial service was yesterday, for the family of David Cox, who haven't even caught their breaths yet, for the families and friends and the beloved community riddled now with small and large deaths, with small and large hurts, you've served. None of that service will bring back Wally or bring back David. We have no magic fingers. We can't even cure a cold. None of that service is guaranteed to heal the hurts of those among us who suffer in different ways. None of it is done so that we can feel good about ourselves for being so darn helpful. It's done because there are starfish on the beach, and we have arms for throwing, and we can do no other. Can we, in this world of ours, so focused on achievement, on advancing causes and fighting the good fight, so wonderfully intent on getting results, dare to be irrelevant and bear before a world that needs us with nothing to offer but our vulnerable selves and our willing hands? Or are we so attached to the importance of our own relevance that our actions are only worth the sum total of their tangible results? Because the story of the star thrower makes me cry. Because I can't talk myself out of believing there has to be more in the doing than just the results at the end. And because I want to believe that the end reward is not the measure of the act, I harbor a hope that we can find the face of the holy even in our own irrelevance, and especially in our own simple acts of service. Could we believe we are loved and we are worthy of that love, not because of what we do or what we accomplish, but because we are held by that love which will not let us go? I think so. I hope so. And I hope that we as leaders and servants to one another can stand together before that ocean of injustice and pain that is vaster than our imaginations. Some days we might just be spectacular. And some days all of our labors will be washed ashore again at our feet. But come what may we be buoyed in the good work, not merely by the measure of our own successes, but by the fact that we are held by one another and by a generous creation that does not let us go, whether or not we save the world.